Welcome to this week's Third Opinion Podcast. This week we will tell you about the British Jewish community reaction to the life and death of Queen Elizabeth. We'll also tell you about blood money being paid to Palestinian terrorists who kill civilians. And we'll have part two of our interview about a worldwide organization that fights anti-Semitism. That and so much more. And don't forget, you can get your third opinion wherever you download your podcasts. And now, this week's Third Opinion Podcast. Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion on WKDW and the podcast Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Laureen Jaffe.
Big week news-wise, Laureen, with the loss of an icon, Queen Elizabeth.
You know, it really is. I was very sad, you know, just to see that. I mean, you know, we all just expect her to be around forever, right? Because she just,
right.
Like, she has been around forever. You know, but just a really extraordinary woman who just loved the Jewish people. But also just, you know, she had carried herself with such dignity and always just sort of like that stalwart, that calming peace that was always there. And it'll be interesting to see. I don't have the same fondness for Charles.
You know, most people don't, but I saw his speech the other day and I was impressed. I thought he did a really good job.
No, I don't know. I mean, I know he's agnostic, and I'm concerned about his attitude towards Israel. And I think we'll see more of that come out. But
we have to keep in mind it's a constitutional monarchy. Yeah. I would have been more concerned of Jeremy Corbyn, who was running for prime minister.
Well, exactly.
Who was definitely anti-Semitic and could have changed things. I mean, he can advise, he can talk things, but truly it's more with Parliament and the prime minister than with now King Charles. But you are right. Queen Elizabeth was really a friend of Israel and the Jewish people who were her subjects in the British Commonwealth. And some people may not realize how friendly she was to the Jewish community. However, one person who was the chief rabbi of England, Rabbi Mirkus, who just had high praise for Queen Elizabeth and her relationship with the Jewish people and the Jewish people with their relationship to her. So let's listen to Rabbi Mirkus.
On behalf of the Jewish communities of the Commonwealth, I convey our most profound condolences on the passing of Her Majesty the Queen. The Queen embodied the most noble values of British society. Throughout her extraordinary reign, she conducted herself with grace, dignity, and humility, and was a global role model for distinguished leadership and selfless devotion to society. In an ever-changing world, she was a rock of stability and a champion of timeless values. Every week in synagogue, we have prayed for her welfare, well-being, and wisdom, and she never let us down. We recall with much appreciation the warm relationship she had with the Jewish community, with a particular commitment to interfaith relations and Holocaust memorial. I recall how, on one occasion, she showed me and my wife items of Jewish interest and value in her private collection in Windsor Castle, including a Torah scroll rescued from Czechoslovakia during the Holocaust. Her affection for the Jewish people ran deep, and her respect for our values was palpable. In life, she was rightly admired and loved the world over. In death, may her memory and legacy be for an everlasting blessing.
You know, she also, Laureen, had a great sense of humor.
She did. But before we go there, I just had to note, because, you know, she also had a wonderful relationship with the prior chief rabbi of England, which was Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who met with her and spoke with her. And just, you know, he certainly respected her tremendously. I mean, I think she always appreciated his counsel and his guidance. And that's, something that I don't think we should take lightly in today.
No, not at all. We should never take lightly when heads of state are friendly to Israel. So yeah, I think that's very important. Let me tell you one story. I love this story. It has nothing to do with Judaism, everything to do with Queen Elizabeth. I saw a thing the other night. One of her trusted aides and perhaps her driver had taken her to some place near the Scottish castle where she liked to spend the summers and where she passed away this past week. And they were walking and came across two American tourists, and they were chatting, and they said, "This is beautiful. Do you come here often?" Queen Elizabeth says, "Yeah, I've been coming here about 80 years." And the tourist said, "Oh, wow, you must know Queen Elizabeth. Have you ever met her?" Queen Elizabeth, it gets better. Queen Elizabeth says, "No, I have never met her, but David here has, her driver." So they said, "Wow." And they said, "What is she like?" And he says, "Well, she can be crotchety, but she has a great sense of humor." So the American tourists were excited. They met someone who knew the Queen, and they said to Queen Elizabeth, "Will you take a picture on our cell phone with this guy who has met the Queen?"
Oh, my God.
They take the picture, and then her driver says to them, he says, "Why don't you take a picture with my friend, too?" So he takes a picture of the two of them with Queen Elizabeth. They have no idea who she is. And then he says, when they got in the car to drive back to the castle, she said, "I would love to be a fly on the wall when they get back to America and show the picture of you and your friend that was with you when other people go, you crazy people, that was Queen Elizabeth." Isn't that a great story?
By the way, I have no idea how they could not have known. Like, it's just so crazy. Like, you know, how they didn't recognize her.
I know, but it is.
Apparently, I mean, one of the most recognizable faces in the world, but
you know, people are funny. You know, I was on TV here in Tampa for 35 years, and every once in a while I'll run into someone and say, "You know, did anybody ever tell you look like Mike Deason?" And I go, "No, I'm much better looking than he is."
That's great. Wow.
So anyway, yeah, that was, and we also ought to mention, we're taping on Sunday, September 11th, 9/11, 21 years ago today. And that still rings true for any of us who are, particularly our age, and remember exactly where we were on that date that changed America forever. And perhaps also it gains some traction with people in America realizing the danger of some of those countries in the Middle East, and not only the hatred for Israel, but the hatred of America. And
right,
that's why we need to be reunited with Israel to fight that.
Right. I mean, Israel's little Satan, America's big Satan. So as the Supreme Leader of Iran likes to say, we are big Satan, they're little Satan. You know, so there's a lot of other interesting things going on this week. I was really disturbed by Apple News this week. Their camera, who we've had a camera on from time to time, you know, to talk about different events going on. It's the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. They had a piece out this week regarding Apple News. Apple News had an article where they praised the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas for his reprehensible remarks that he made in Berlin, accusing Israel of you know, really horrific things. So it was,
he talked about Israel having a fifth Holocaust.
Exactly. Israel is committing a Holocaust against the Palestinian people, which, by the way, shocked the Chancellor of Germany, who was standing on the stage with him. He made some really poignant attacks against Israel while on stage with the German Chancellor, who we think was just like in a state of shock. But at once, Apple News actually applauded Abbas, calling his statements poignant and powerful. And so Camera is asking the community to reach out to Apple News to make this aware, to make them aware of this, that to call this out as anti-Semitism. And bring that to their attention and tell them that, you know, this is not acceptable. You know, the lies that were spoken by a boss were absolutely reprehensible. And to have, you know, your news outlet call them poignant and powerful was very disturbing. So I think there are cameras right now asking people to take a stand and to reach out to Apple News. And you can go to Camera's website as well. And they have a link there for you to follow if you want to. But I think that's important that, again, this is...
I think that people need to cry out against a boss who, in essence, is a dictator. I mean, what has it been, 15 years since they've had an election?
Right.
12 or 15 years, something like that. He keeps putting it off. He is as corrupt as can be. You sent me a story about ghost hospitals that Palestinian Authority got. How many millions of dollars?
I think it was $220 million. You're right.
Dollars to build hospitals. So they build them. There's no patients. There's no doctors. There's no nurses. They absconded with the money. This is such a corrupt organization. And to give this guy any credibility is just crazy.
Exactly. So it's like, well, and then the question is, where did the money go? Well, we all know where it went. It went to their corrupt pockets is where it went.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or the paying terrorists who kill people. I mean, because...
Speaking of paying terrorists who kill people, Israel got another friend this week from another country. Senator Holly Hughes of Australia was on a visit to Israel, and then she saw how the Palestinians reward the killers of civilians by paying them blood money.
It's their budget. It's a line item.
It is just disgusting. And I was thrilled to hear how disgusted she was as she spoke to the Australian Senate. Let's take a listen and applaud Senator Holly Hughes.
Acting Deputy President. Well, last week I was fortunate enough to be in Israel, hosted by the wonderful organisation known as AJAC. We spent time both in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv. But what was potentially one of the most eye-opening parts of the trip that we did was a visit to Ramallah. And whilst in Ramallah, we met with the Palestinian Prime Minister, as well as being given a tour through what is referred to as a refugee camp, but is a settlement. These are permanent buildings. And perhaps one of the most disturbing things I have ever seen, pointed out by our Palestinian guide, and to quote her, that this monument we were looking at was to commemorate the suicide bombers who had killed Jewish civilians. And these people were being immortalised in monuments in this centre in Ramallah. Now, when I spoke to the Prime Minister of Palestine from the PA in his office about this and how by immortalising these people, by not even adhering to the basic principles of the rule of war, by actively killing civilians, how could they ever expect a conversation? But the fact that the Palestinians have a policy that is colloquially known, and in fact even I think that's a bit more formal than that, as pay for slay. Pay for slay. If you kill a Jewish civilian and sent to jail, you receive circa 12,000 shekels per month. That is 3 to 4 times what the average teacher gets paid. If you happen to be killed, your family receives this money. This money comes from the international community. It is a disgrace, and this is backed by the ABC, hence by the removal of failed Abu Ghosh Twitter account.
She was great, and she was outraged, and we're thankful for that because it's just crazy. The Palestinian Authority is paying murderers, rewarding them, killing civilians. Yeah, good job. And if you get killed, we'll take care of your family.
By the way, it's a lifelong distribution. You get a monthly payment. And I think that's what's so disturbing. That's a line item on the Palestinian Authority's annual budget. And that's part of the problem of approving funding to the PA, that when those, you know, when the U.S. government is sending money and aid, you know, there has not been historically, and there still is not, you know, real ways of auditing that and ensuring that it's not going on that payroll. And that's a significant issue, right? So You know, I think we all need to be concerned about that and aware that that is on their annual budget. It is a line item, and they're not ashamed of it, and they're not taking it away.
It's concerning. But you know what else is concerning to me as we're talking about Palestine and the Middle East, the Palestinians, is that the Hamas chief went to Moscow this week to meet with the Russians. That is a bad alliance for Israel.
Yeah, Ismail Haniyeh is there again meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. This is not the first time they've met. They've actually had multiple meetings, and he's back there again. And, you know, if you all recall, just a few months ago, you know, again, Russia was very quick to condemn Israel for their operation against the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. I think the question of is well, we already know that Moscow is, you know, in close relations with Iran
and Syria.
And Hamas gets funding from Iran. And so, is Russia now a conduit of that funding? I don't know. You know, what type of weapons would they be supplying Hamas with? I mean, that's what concerns me. I mean, are we giving, you know, Hamas upgraded weapons? I mean, because the one thing that was very clear after the 2021 conflict, when Hamas was attacking Israel, right, there were 5,000 rockets launched into Israel and into civilian neighborhoods. I mean, Israel directly targeted the tunnel system in Gaza where the Hamas operatives kept their weapons and where the militants hid, right? And because Israel targeted that tunnel system, Hamas took a major hit. I mean, and I think Jonathan Shanzer, when he was on this show a couple of weeks ago with Foundation for Defense and Democracies, talked about that. I mean, they took a pretty serious hit on their infrastructure, on their cache of weapons. And so I think, the one thing that concerns me about these meetings that they're having with Russia is, you know, to what extent is Russia going to start supplying them with more sophisticated weapons, and is Iran paying them somehow, giving the cash to Russia and then Russia supplying? I don't know, but it's something that we need to keep a close eye on. I will say that I am very concerned about this.
Yeah, I am too. I don't know if we talked about this last week or not, but it came out this week that the Israeli army admits that it was their bullet that killed journalist Shireen Abu Akila. I think it was a collateral damage. I don't think she was targeted at all. It's dangerous for war correspondents, but there was such controversy on that. And now Israel is admitting that it was one of their bullets.
Right. The bullet. They determined that it was an errant bullet, during the gunfighting that somehow, you know, was over there, and it's unfortunate. But, you know, she was in a position where she knew that there were militants who were planning terrorist attacks, was aware that the special forces were performing a raid to get those terrorists who were planning a very significant terrorist attacks within Israel against civilians. And, you know, she put herself at risk. And that's always a danger. I think what's interesting is that the media was silent about the killing of the Arab journalists this week by the Arab Israeli, by what we believe are other Arabs. There's his name, this Arab Israeli journalist, Nidal Akbaria. He was 44 years old. He had his own Arabic language news site, and he was exposing, you know, some of the Arab mob crime. So in a lot of the Arab neighborhoods in Israel, and this has been a big issue for a long time, there are these warlords, these crime lords, and almost like mob bosses, Arab mob bosses, that are members of Hamas or different, you know, Palestinian Islamic Jihad or whatever, and they sort of terrorize their own neighborhoods and their own communities. And he would expose them for their crime, and he was shot to death, unfortunately, in front of his family's home this week in his car.
But you know, Laureen, being an investigative journalist, fortunately not a ton are killed, but it, you know, I was an investigative journalist for years and years. And it was threatened several times. Fortunately, nothing happened. Mostly I was threatened to be sued, but it's dangerous. And there wasn't much media coverage. There was a little in this country, but not a ton on Jeff German. Do you know who Jeff German is?
Can't recall.
Okay. Jeff German was an investigative reporter in Las Vegas who was stabbed to death last week by a county official who he had done all sorts of stories about, allegedly stabbed by him, but they found evidence that certainly appears to link him to the crime.
I'm sorry, I forgot. That's right.
But that's what I'm saying. It's not top of mind. You shouldn't necessarily know. Those things get glossed over for some reason. It's in the news. It's gone. So the same thing with the journalist that was killed, Nadal. How do you say it? Agbaria, I think.
Agbaria.
Yeah.
Agbaria, right?
Yeah. So I know it's just sad.
It is sad. I mean, I was very disappointed. You know, I mean, you just see these things that happen to these people, and it makes you sad. I thought it was interesting also this week. I mean, we should talk about University of Wisconsin.
My mom's alma mater. And I applied there, but Missouri was my first choice. But because my mom graduated from University of Wisconsin.
Your mom would have been horrified, right? Because
absolutely horrified. Absolutely. There were anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic graffiti all over a beautiful, beautiful campus. But that's how it greeted the students coming back to school this fall.
Exactly. So there's somebody, you know, wrote all over the sidewalks on campus, Zionism is racism, Zionism is genocide, referred to Zionist organizations and accusing them of having blood on their hands, like Hillel in different places, in different organizations on campus. And I think that was really like, so there's something like 4,000 Jewish students that go there. So I think that was very disturbing for those students to return to, you know, first day of classes. And I thought the school's response was very weak. The school, said, quote, "While we do not know who created these chalkings and acknowledge the impact they had, nonetheless, we also acknowledge they represent free speech, which is a core value of UW. Just because something isn't prohibited doesn't make it a good idea. Our expectation is that we engage across differences and discuss varying views and ideas with civility and respect, and that did not happen here."
Crossed the line. That's like yelling fire in a crowded theater to me.
Right. And I guess the University of Wisconsin doesn't have any anti-discrimination laws or rules regarding student conduct. I mean, I don't know. Most universities do. I mean, Florida does, thank God. Like, this would have been considered inappropriate conduct at a Florida university based upon rules that apply here in our state. So I'm just, because Florida adopted the International Holocaust Association's definition of anti-Semitism, but I guess Wisconsin hasn't yet. But that, to me, is clear anti-Semitism and hate speech, and students
that cannot be tolerated. Right. That's not a matter of free speech. It's hate speech. And we all have to stand up against hate speech. I'm a big First Amendment guy, but when it crosses the line into hate speech, it cannot be tolerated, and people must speak out. You mentioned anti-Semitism, which is a big reason that we do this show, to expose anti-Semitism that goes on. And as any regular listener knows, we have found it grows and grows and grows. And I wonder sometimes, why is there such anti-Semitic feeling throughout the world against us? We have a terrific piece explaining why anti-Semitism still exists. Let's take a listen.
If you asked most Westerners today whether they oppose anti-Semitism, most would likely say yes. And yet, whenever something terrible happens in the world, it seems like it's only a matter of time before someone blames the Jews for it. The problem is not just words. It's conspiracy theories that have deadly consequences, as massacres of Jews from Pittsburgh to Paris demonstrate.
At lunchtime today, a man armed with machine guns walked into this kosher supermarket and took more than a dozen people hostage.
The gunman was killed, but tragically so too were four of the hostages.
Far from fading away, anti-Jewish prejudice seems as resilient as ever. So if we agree that anti-Semitism is bad, why is it still such a big problem? That's where this series comes in. by answering some of the biggest questions about anti-Semitism, the sort that confuse many people and keep them from seeing and confronting the hate. We'll learn together how to effectively tackle anti-Semitism, what it actually is, how to recognize it, and what to do about it. Didn't anti-Semitism go away after the Holocaust?
Jews will not replace us!
Apparently not. Yet a surprising number of people think that anti-Jewish bigotry was stamped out after the horrors of Nazi Germany. After all, didn't we make a bunch of Holocaust movies and get past this stuff? But while it's comforting to imagine that anti-Semitism largely disappeared after World War II, it's far from accurate. And if we make the mistake of reducing anti-Semitism to the Holocaust, its most extreme manifestation, we're likely to miss much of the problem today. That's because the Holocaust wasn't an anti-Semitic exception. It was anti-Semitism's culmination. The systematic murder of 6 million Jews across Europe didn't happen in a vacuum. It came after years of religious, scientific, cultural, and political anti-Semitism. For centuries, European Jews were barred from most professions, forcibly converted to other faiths, and subjected to murderous rampages, constant expulsions, and periodic inquisitions. In other words, the mass murder of European Jewry would not have been possible without many centuries of anti-Jewish ideas and assumptions. Take the Holocaust away, and you still have this massive anti-Semitic foundation underneath. In fact, we are still living with it. Put another way, just as slavery's abolition in America didn't end racism, the defeat of Nazi Germany didn't end anti-Semitism. The statistics bear this out. According to the FBI, American Jews are annually subject to the most hate crimes of any religious group, despite making up only 2% of the US population. Not only that, but since the FBI began tracking these crimes, more of them have been committed against Jews than all these groups combined. Hate crime statistics are an imperfect metric, but they give you a sense of the ugly anti-Jewish undercurrent that has always lurked beneath the surface. Recently, more people have started to notice this unsettling reality, as American Jews have been subjected to a series of anti-Semitic terrorist attacks and massacres. These include the mass shooting at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in October 2018.
Contact! Contact! Shots fired! Shots fired!
The April 2019 attack on a synagogue in Poway, California. The shooting at a kosher supermarket in Jersey City, New Jersey in December 2019.
Three people inside that store were killed by flying pieces of metal during the gunfire.
There is no question that this is a hate crime, and anti-Semitism should be called out aggressively and firmly, immediately, for what it is.
And the mass stabbing of religious Jews at their Hanukkah celebration that same month by a machete-wielding assailant in Muncie, New York. Yet as bad as this is, the picture is considerably darker in Europe. In 2018, CNN surveyed European attitudes towards Jewish people. They found that more than a quarter of Europeans believe that Jews have too much influence in finance. Nearly 1 in 4 said that Jews had too much influence in wars and conflicts around the world. 1 in 5 Europeans said that Jews had too much influence in the media, and almost the same number claimed that they have too much influence in politics. These conspiracy theories about vast Jewish power are particularly ludicrous when you realize that Jews constitute less than 0.2% of the entire European population. And most Europeans have never even met one. The consequences of this widespread hostility towards Jews, however, are severe. In 2013 and 2018, researchers at the European Union's Agency for Fundamental Rights asked Jews about their experiences of anti-Semitism. What they found was alarming. Nearly 40% of European Jews were afraid of publicly identifying as Jewish. Nearly half were worried about being the victim of anti-Semitic harassment in the next 12 months. And 1/3 feared being the victim of a physical assault. And for good reason. In recent years, Jews have been the victims of brutal anti-Semitic attacks at schools and synagogues across Europe. Put together, it's easy to understand why so many of Europe's Jews still live in fear 75 years after the Holocaust, why nearly 40% of them say they've considered leaving because they don't feel safe, and why millions of them already have. The same is true in many non-Western countries. Jews in Arab and Muslim lands once numbered nearly 1 million, but now number only a few thousand, having been persecuted to the point of expulsion or flight in the last century. And anti-Jewish prejudice has persisted throughout the region, even in the absence of Jews. Why does this matter to us? Because if we only see and confront anti-Semitism when it looks like the Holocaust or is committed by obvious actors like neo-Nazis, we're likely to miss much of it. Which means that society will only notice the problem when it explodes into deadly violence, as in Pittsburgh or Paris, and it's already too late. Instead, we should understand the Holocaust as a cautionary tale for what happens when more common outgrowths of anti-Semitism go unchecked and resolve to beat those back together. As for how to do that, well, first we need to settle the biggest question about anti-Semitism of all. Whose fault is anti-Semitism?
You know, it's been around since the beginning of time, it seems to me, right after Abraham made the pact with God. Anti-Semitism started popping up way back then, and I don't think it's anything that's ever going to go away, but we've got to fight it on every level.
You know, I mean, there is always the warning in the Book of Devarim. It says that in every generation, there will be those who rise up against you. You know, and to train your children's hands for battle. I mean, it's a very important. And I think that we all have that. We all, every generation has their place in this fight. And we all have to take our position and stand against it. You know, and I think that's, again, an important reminder is, you know, Rosh Hashanah is, you know, less than 2 weeks away, sundown the evening of September 25th. And that Rosh Hashanah is the Feast of Trumpets as we enter in the season. You know, as I said, where we, you know, crown Hashem as King of the Universe. And then, you know, we come into Yom Kippur and then into Sukkot, which is also known as the Festival of Our Joy. Sort of when you think about the referencing the first time we sort of built that Sukkah, the Mishkan, in the wilderness right after our first observance of Yom Kippur. You know, the Mishkan, which was, you know, God's dwelling place in the wilderness with us, a tent of meeting there. And that occurred on what was soon become Sukkot, the Festival of Our Joy. And so this is a season that we're entering into. And I think it's really important that we, you know, reflect on all these things and in this time right now as we move forward into the year ahead, and that we all, you know, take our place and know that we all each have a responsibility for the next generation. I think it's really important to push back on it. So,
and speaking of responsibility, you did an interview with Michael Dixon that we played part one last week, talking about anti-Semitism, how to fight it, and ethnic studies that have hurt Jewish kids throughout the country. We're going to get to that right after we take a quick break. This is The Third Opinion. That interview in just a moment. But have you looked at our webpage, where you can listen to previous editions of the Third Opinion podcast, find out more about our hosts, and leave a comment or two? And now, back to the Third Opinion podcast and that interview. Welcome back to the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW and the podcast. I'm Mike Thiessen.
Green Jaffe.
Talk a little bit about Michael Dixon.
Absolutely. So Michael Dixon is the executive director for Stand With Us. Last week, as Mike mentioned, we had part one on. He continues the conversation this week. You know, education, 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 really the goal of Stand With Us, and fighting back against a lot of what we see now and sort of under the ethnic studies education and what, you know, Stand With Us helped do to fight and continue to fight some of these issues in California, but also what they do to help students across the country on their college campuses, even in high schools, elementary schools, middle schools, to fight the increasing discrimination and sort of removing the Jewish story and treating Jews as if they're, you know, white privilege and taking away thousands of years of hate, discrimination, pogroms, murders, you know, forced conversions, and you know, the Jewish story. And I, you know, I applaud him for doing this. And so with that, here's part two with Michael Dixon. Absolutely. So let's talk about ethnic studies. I know CAMRA, Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis, on September 8th is doing an in-depth piece on ethnic studies. And so those of you listening, if you're interested, you can go to their website. But I know you also, Stand With Us is also focused on this. It's really been a hot button, especially in California, When we look at the teachers unions, the National Teachers Union, Mike and I talked about this, the National Teachers Union at their annual conference had multiple anti-Israel, anti-Jewish, what do you call it? Their legislation for to be voted on by their members.
Yeah,
and you know, calling whether it was calling Israel an apartheid state, condemning Israel, and the even though they didn't pass, they still had a very significant vote in favor of. Way too close for my comfort. And we know that a lot of the teachers unions in California definitely drive that, and they are more far left. So we now have this sort of, you know, anomaly or this sort of enigma of ethnic studies in California. And after many complaints by the Jewish community, the governor took out certain language, but it sort of still left it to the local teachers and the schools, which to me is very dangerous knowing where the unions stand. So I think there's a lot of people who listen and they think that, you know, they think when people are attacking CRT or ethnic studies that it's somehow a party line issue. This isn't about Republican or Democrat. This isn't about racism or not racism. This is about how these programs are being used in many ways to sort of, again, whitewash Jews and make Jews sort of the white colonizers. And I think it's a real problem here. So, you know, you're in this space. I mean, can you sort of add some color to this for, because I think a lot of people still don't really get it here in the States. They think it's just sort of a politic thing, but it's not. It's actually very real.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think it's a worthy goal. The basic goal of ethnic studies is meant to be to ensure the histories and the experiences of marginalized communities and to make sure that that's represented in public education. You know, what could be wrong with that? Well, we have to understand, as you said, that at the same time, there are specific interest groups who are relentlessly trying to exploit the ethnic studies courses as a platform for anti-Israel and anti-Zionist propaganda and anti-Semitism and other forms of bias. And that's where the problem lies. So what we did as an organization is release an ethnic studies toolkit. And the resource is made to educate the public about how K-12 ethnic studies courses can impact the Jewish community and offer tools for activism on a state level, on a local level, on a district level across the United States. And basically what we've done is taken from our experience working with students and partner organizations and concerned citizens who were working with us in California to remove the hatred and bias that was ingrained in the California ethnic studies model curriculum. And so this has actually been a learning experience for us. Our head office is based in California. And what we're trying to do now is to share this guide so that we can advocate better public education when it comes to anti-Semitism, Jewish culture, and also the Jewish community's history in the United States. And we want to keep that hatred and bias out of K-12 classrooms. So this struggle in California was a big wake-up call. And it's exactly as you say, Lorraine, you know, it's not right and left. We have to work together to prevent these same problems from coming up in, you know, schools across the country. And so we created this toolkit that we can share with concerned parents, with communities, to make sure that they get their voices heard when they face the same issues in their own local communities as they did in California.
And again, Michael, that's available if a parent is interested, because, you know, Mike and I have talked about, we do see from time to time articles coming up where parents all of a sudden are learning something anti-Jewish or anti-Israel being taught to their child in you know, elementary school or middle school. And, you know, they're trying to file a complaint with the school board and maybe they're not being heard. So again, these materials, you know, to help parents sort of work their way through the system when, you know, it's ethnic studies is being used for wrong reasons versus for right reasons. You know,
that's right. And the truth is that within ethnic studies, they're teaching about race and ethnicity and indigeneity.
Yeah.
But there's no mention of Jewish indigeneity to Israel. There's very little or no mention of, you know, anti-Semitism and what that is, and Jews being a marginalized community as well. And there's no mention of the diversity of what Israel is. So one of the the ways we see anti-Semitism present itself today is that Jews are being portrayed as, you know, white and colonialist in Israel and actually being part of a supposedly oppressive system. And that couldn't be further from the truth. And of course, we know the stories, the rich Jewish history of where Jews have been all over the world and where they come from and where they were dispersed to, and also the very real struggles they've had against discrimination. And why shouldn't this be taught as part of this curriculum?
Wow. Oh, that's amazing. You know, it's always sort of, you know, I always take a step back, because the other thing that we see oftentimes too, and this is becoming a new trend here in the States, where universities that have, for instance, Middle East study programs or our Jewish programs are being led by individuals who are very anti-Israel, anti-Jew,
right.
Which is amazing to me. Like, how do you have a Middle East studies program that doesn't even allow, you know, traditional Jewish studies, that, but rather is teaching about Israel being an apartheid, and instead of speaking about the truth of what Israel is, as you just mentioned, and how ethnically diverse Israel is. I mean, not just the Arab and the Jew, but that even 50, over half the Jews who live there are Mizrahi Sephardic Jews. They're from the Middle East. They're from Africa. They're from Iraq. They're from Iran. They're, you know, from Tunisia and Syria and just everywhere. So it's amazing how people are very uninformed here in the States. So that's it's a very important program that you're offering there.
Thank you. And they're uninformed. And like you say, there are people who are pushing disinformation. I mean, you had the head of Google's diversity and inclusion program about this time last year, had to be reassigned because he'd made anti-Semitic statements publicly on the internet. So yes, we have a problem when the people who are charged with teaching others about inclusion are excluding Jews. We have a problem.
Right. So let me move to the next topic, because I know we're running short on time, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about it, because you just wrote a book.
I did. Yes.
Is resilience about, you know, since IS and the resilience for Israel, so is resilience. Share with the audience a little bit about this book and why you wrote it.
So we've spoken about, you know, the unfair representation of Israel. And actually, Israel for me isn't a place that just needs to be accepted. It needs to be respected. And I've lived here for 16 years. And in that time, I have seen war and peace and terror attacks and adversity and amazing things as well. And so my contention was there is something innately resilient about the Israeli people. And I set about, together with a pioneering psychologist in the field of resilience, I said about meeting Israelis from all different backgrounds, some of them famous, some of them not. We went north to south, east to west. Our oldest interviewee was 90, and our youngest was in their 20s, all different backgrounds. What we do is basically hear their stories and extrapolate their resilient keys in order to teach people how to be resilient based on the Israeli experience. And you know what it's like here. It's breathtaking in that you don't know when you wake up in the morning how the day is going to end. You could have regional leaders deposed. You could have a mini war start and finish within a weekend. So that engenders some kind of amazing resilience, plus our incredible history, plus all the things that go into being Israeli. So it's been a fascinating journey. We come across three Israelian keys, which I will share with your audience, and they are empathy, flexibility, and meaning making. And we find out from these incredible Israelis of all different backgrounds how they have worked out, you know, overcome a challenge and really risen above it. We spoke to people who suffered terror attacks. We spoke to an amazing man by the name of Noam Gershoni, who fell out of the sky in an Apache helicopter and ended up recovering and becoming Israel's first gold Paralympic medalist in the London 2012 Olympic Games. We spoke to Ethiopians who walked through the desert in order to get to Israel and how they overcame their adversity. We spoke to amazing Arab citizens of Israel as well. So it really was such an incredible experience. And the book is Resilience is out now on all different platforms.
Well, I love that it's a positive book, and we can end at least on a positive note.
Absolutely. And you know what? There's so much positive, and what's positive is how people are coming together through Stand With Us to support Israel. In our 21 years, we've reached millions of people through social media and all of our programming. And as much as I get to see some of the very worst anti-Semitism that's out there, I also get to see and meet the incredible people who are standing up and saying, you know, we won't accept this and we'll fight against it, and who are embracing of Israel, and they come from all different backgrounds. So there's definitely much to be hopeful about.
That's wonderful news. So I'm really glad, Michael, that we got to end on a positive note. So everyone, Michael Dixon, the executive director of Stand With Us, he's coming to us today live from Israel. He is, which I was very excited to learn that your offices are right across the street from the King David in Jerusalem.
Yes, I should say, if you're visiting Israel, come see us. We are across the street, as you said, from the King David Hotel. We have a visitor center and experience, really something that you should come and see. If you have a look at standwithusexperience.com, you can see our center and book a visit. And of course, I must say that your audience should connect with Jake Shapiro, who you're friends with, the wonderful Jake, who's our regional director in Florida. If they want to email him, he's jakes@standwithus.com. jakes@standwithus.com. He's incredible, and he'll be happy to make all of our Stand With Us resources available to your audience.
Absolutely. That is wonderful. Well, thank you again, Michael, and we look forward to having you back on the show.
All the best. Thank you.
Absolutely.
He lays it out pretty well about how there are problems with anti-Semitism still popping up, with ethnic studies that are going on campus. You know, and one of the things that some people say, and we've talked about this before, that the Jews are not white people. I don't get that, Laureen. Listen, I am the original white person. I am so pale. I mean, I don't get that.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, you're Ashkenaz, right? So the majority of in the world, as well as in Israel, are not Ashkenaz. They're Sephardic and Mizrahi. They're Middle Eastern Jews. They're Middle Eastern Northern African Jews, because that is our culture. That's who we are. That's where we're from. I mean, there was a few Jews who went up to the Russia, and that's where they lived in that territory. And those are the Ashkenazi family bloodlines. But the majority of family bloodlines of Jews in the world are not Ashkenaz.
Sephardic is bigger than Ashkenazi?
Sephardic. Yeah, I mean, there's over 500 patriarchal bloodlines, you know, versus Ashkenazi and the Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews is the majority of the Jewish population in Israel. And I think that's, you know, there's a sort of this misconception, because in America, there's so many German and Russian Jews that people don't appreciate the diversity of Jews. And, you know, I think, by the way, and I have to point this out, because I think the ADL this week really upset me as well with the expose about, and I'm glad the ADL is now going back, by the way, I should mention before I dig into the story, the ADL is going to do a full review of their own ethnic studies, because ADL always provide lesson plans for teachers for high schools, middle schools, elementary schools, and teachers across the country relied upon ADL for these lesson plans, but they have lesson plans called Power and Privilege, lesson plans that talk about white privilege, lesson plans that sort of go along a lot of these privilege statements that sort of, again, that have been utilized by many to sort of delegitimize the Jewish struggle. And it was very disturbing to see this. And Jonathan Greenblatt said, you know, we're doing an analysis because clearly this is not consistent with our mission statement.
Well, they certainly made some missteps with the Women's March, which had a good good goal. But the people who were running it were clearly anti-Semitic. I mean, it was, you know, it was like great that women were marching for rights for women. But the people who led it, like Linda Sorsauer and who's the other one?
Her name is escaping me, but she.
Yeah, me too. But they were clearly anti-Semitic people that were at the forefront of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, but it goes beyond just the Women's March. I mean, there was so much in their lesson plans about power and privilege, you know, saying that white women are justly seen as being oppressive and that they enjoy unearned skin privilege and things like that, that they're teaching these attitudes without, you know, and I the concern is that sort of falls right into that CRT, that ethnic studies that tries to twist this stuff and use it to, you know, make Jews seem like they're part of this privileged class, and that, you know, to take away our thousands of years of struggle.
But okay, tell me what woke is. I mean, I hear people use it. It's a term that's used in a pejorative way. I have no idea what woke means.
Are very unwoke. I think the people who use it in a pejorative way are actually very uninformed, misinformed.
Oh, no, politicians use it all the time. Yes. It's in the ads. It's all that. And I look and I go, okay, tell me what the hell that means. I don't understand that.
Far left uses the language of, are you woke? Meaning, don't you get the racism, the discrimination? Don't you get all these ideas? Aren't you woke? Because that's their language in the far left. And the socialist movement, it's the wokeness, right? If you look at the Democratic Socialist Party of America, that's right up their alley with their intersectionality and what they call being woke. And I would actually say that's actually, you know,
it's such a small percentage.
It is, but it isn't. I mean, it's very dangerous. I mean, all I have to do is look at the spread of socialism in Latin America right now and in our back door. We should be very concerned about what's happening and you know, what has happened in some of the cities in America. And I think people who did elect those socialist-like leaders are now regretting it. And you're seeing there is a shift to remove some of those people, for instance, in Minnesota or in San Francisco. But you can't take it lightly. It's a very damning thing. And why I would say it is this, because any ism, socialism, fascism, communism, is anti-God, anti-religious freedom. All you have to do is look at China. Every religious minority, from Muslims to Christians to Ungars to Falun Gong, are literally, they send you to re-education camps where your bodies are mutilated, where you're abused, where you're killed. They literally, and this is not a conspiracy theory, they harvest organs of these prisoners. They kill them. They execute them all the time. They don't believe in freedom of religion because God is a threat to their supreme authority. I mean, and so it's this, you know, you have to be aware of these concepts, which is why Stalin, you know, banned religion, banned God. It's why Hitler, you know, tried to control the church and the Catholic Church, and why the Pope pretty much did whatever Hitler told him to do. I mean,
but you know, okay, we're almost out of time, but real quickly, on the other side, on the far right, there is such anti-Semitism. Marjorie Taylor Greene comparing Biden's speech to Hitler and putting a meme out on social media with a Hitler mustache. The Libertarian Party putting a Hitler mustache on Zelensky. I mean, on the right, it's just as dangerous, Laureen. The far right, the far left, they are not within the mainstream of America.
Well, I don't agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene, but I said it last week. Biden's speech with the red and the black, it was very eerie. And to me, it was very Third Reich-ish when I just watched clips of it.
I thought it was the best speech he's given of his life, quite frankly. And I applauded it. I don't know about the
I thought it was very divisive. And for a man who ran on the platform about—
Wait a second. The MAGA people who say he's not president, that's not divisive? You've got people running for office that say he is not the president of the United States. That's not divisive?
There are countless Democrats, including his press secretary, who, when Trump won in 2016, said he was an illegitimate president. He didn't win. Hillary Clinton talked about that on the road.
No, Hillary Clinton right away conceded and said he won. Yeah, but said he won.
The road— Then she went on the road and for years during his presidency called him an illegitimate president.
No, she did not. He did not win the popular vote, which she pointed out, but she never called him an illegitimate president. She conceded, said he's the president. I lost. That is not true, Laureen. But listen.
I'm also fighting for to have, you know, let's change the Electoral College. All you have to do is go back and listen to her speeches. She was giving paid speeches around the world. And she openly called him that. I mean, this is the you know,
you gotta— not Laureen, but we can't, we're out of time. Hear that music? We'll have to pick it up at some other time. This is the Third Opinion. We're available wherever your podcasts are available. And on WKDW, I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Laureen Jaffe.
Bye. That's our show for this week. Hope you'll join us again next week. And don't forget, subscribe to the Third Opinion podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.